happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, while any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. We're talking about war, nationhood, the price of heroism, leaderhood. They're all at the center in this round, talking about Henry V, the Shakespeare play, about a land grab war, England in France in the 15th century, a play made new by the Actors Shakespeare Project in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The director, Normie Noel, and the actor playing Henry, Seth Powers, are our guests with Coppelia Khan, who teaches Shakespeare here at Brown. Normie Noel, would you start us? We're talking about the all-time image of the boy king becoming a manly man and a chieftain on the battlefield. But he's new in every production, including yours. What's going on here? And who is this Henry, the warlike Harry, after all?
Well, as you say, Chris, everybody has a different take on this guy. And I think when I first started reading him, when Ben Evett, the artistic director at ASP, asked me to do this and suggested five people, I first was daunted, and then I got really excited by it because I think his intuition was dead right, and that we both agreed that this play is an indictment of war.
Five actors to play the whole cast, you mean? How do you get from there to the indictment?
I think as I was reading it, one of the lines that leapt out at me was, "The king has killed his heart." Hmm. And Nell Quickly, the hostess, Mistress Quickly, says this as Falstaff is dying. And as I started doing my, background reading in the earlier plays, for me, and Seth and I don't necessarily agree on this. I don't know, Seth. I won't speak for you. Seth is playing Henry V.
You'll get a chance.
Good. So my sense was, that this young guy was not joining his father, Henry IV, Bolingbroke, in the wars. He was going off to war from time to time, but his real friends were, the East Enders, the London lowlife. And Falstaff seemed to me to be the man that he turned to, Falstaff being the man who most debunks war, pomp, ceremony. And seeing as Henry was aligning himself with this guy, and then suddenly, once he has to, take on becoming king, he turns against Falstaff. And when he does this, it's everybody sees this, it's deeply humiliating to Falstaff. And Falstaff dies. And as Mistress Quickly points out, the king killed his heart by turning away from him. And then I started thinking about, what is it that a patriarchal culture asks a young man to do in order to kill? And I think Shakespeare has mapped a brilliant, the word you used before, Chris, a confounding map here as to how we do that, And with his Henry, I think that he shows, and I don't know if I've necessarily captured it completely in this play, but it certainly feels to me as though he's showing us how not just young men, but people have to armor their own hearts against their own feelings, and then if we renounce what we love, what happens to us?
That's an astonishing twist, actually, to suppose that the line, "the king hath killed his heart," is about the king's heart.
Yes.
I mean, the received wisdom, even applied to our president, George W. Bush, is that the wastrel prince put aside all those frivolous people. He was young and irresponsible when he was young and irresponsible, but now he's become a mature man. Your implication here, and is it yours, or do you suppose Shakespeare's, that no, kingship destroys the human?
Yes, I say yes to both. I think that I very much think Shakespeare was saying that, and that, what is it in a patriarchal culture? What are the tools of a patriarchal culture that insist that a young man prove himself by, in the extreme, being able to kill? And if he doesn't, he's chicken. And I think about my father, who was a combat veteran. He flew heavy bombers in World War II. And one of the things that he used to talk about was once you hit, you know, enemy coast and you had seven guys watching you, what you would do alone. He said, you know, I would have dropped my bombs in the North Sea, but you have seven guys there watching you and you're not going to show that you're a coward, so you drop them on target. And I think that's a strong tool in a patriarchal culture. And, you know, a friend of mine, Jim Gilligan, has written a book about shame being at the bottom of how young men have to adjust their own senses of themselves in order to be seen as men in this hierarchy.
It turns the whole thing upside down, Normie, in a way. There are so many contradictions in the language of this play. It is the home of the greatest war speeches in our language, especially Henry to the troops on the eve of Agincourt, the Band of Brothers speech. But also, it's a bloodthirsty play in the killing of prisoners, in the whole idea of a small band of warriors taking on a much bigger French force and winning. You're saying that's not just irony here, but a kind of mockery, a mockery in the play of itself.
I won't pretend that I understand this play on its deepest level, Chris. I see it. I think the way, you know, this is completely my take, but one of the things that leapt out at me is at the end of the play in the French court, the French king, played by Ken Cheesman, talks to Henry about seeing his daughter, Catherine, who Henry's about to marry, and the countries that Henry's about to, the towns and villages in France he's about to inherit, as an animorph being, you know, a picture that you there are two faces and you have to see them perspectively. And this image of an animorph suddenly to me became this key or this clue in understanding what, you know, I joked to Ben Evett, the artistic director, and said Hamlet feels like a cakewalk compared to this play because of the layering I think that Shakespeare has had to do in just what you said, the ironies that he's set up. I actually think I can only see if I look at one side, which is these young men. I'm completely blown away when, you know, when Seth does the Crispin speech. I want to go to war with them. And I am a conscientious, you know, war is, I'm completely against it. And I don't understand my own response to that speech. And that's what blows me away, because I think Shakespeare gets the power of how we fall into the courage of these young people doing what they need to do in order to stay alive and indeed to win. I mean, Henry kills the POWs and he bloody well wins because he does it. But he also breaks the chivalric code, the Geneva Convention, the whole thing. Then you flip to the other side and start to see, you know, is this really the way that we have to, that we deal with conflict? Do we have to kill each other in order to do this? And I think Shakespeare has us flipping back and forth. He juxtaposes the scenes so that you have these, you know, the fools and the clowns squabbling over nothing. And then you have the glory of war. And I think he's doing this very pointedly.
The amazing thing about watching this now as a grown-up, after seeing Laurence Olivier in the movies, is to hear all the back talk against war in the play. Starting with Henry himself at the beginning, he says, take heed how you awake our sleeping sword of war. He knows the peril even before it begins. But then the troops are all against the war, it seems, even the officers. Certainly the Williams, it's one of the great anti-war speeches. Think about all those limbs coming together again in purgatory or heaven or wherever and screaming out in pain for their wives and each other. Can you identify Shakespeare's voice here in all the give and take, all the back and forth about war, Normie?
I guess what I see, Chris, is a young playwright who is putting his plays up in front of very powerful censors and Elizabeth, who has been, you know, a warrior herself. So how do you, as a playwright, not have your deepest heart, what you believe is true? How do you get that on stage and not have, it's an incredible feat that he did to not have this play censored, in my opinion, to sort of layer the truth in a lot of the joking and the juxtaposition of the clowns against what it feels to me Williams is, you know, for me too, Williams is the heart of this play. But it's far more complex than that, and I know that, you know, from having spent a lot of time with combat with Vietnam veterans, that it's a complex thing to actually have been at war, to have understood, and I know this from my father, to have understood what it was in your heart that got you there. How did the culture back that? What was the moment, the confusion in oneself? What is the question that you know that you could ask yourself about why am I killing somebody else in order to solve something? Surely this is wrong. And when do we stop asking that question? And what is the culture doing to back that up? How does the culture hold these people? How does it hold us so that we become confused? And I think at the very end, you know, when Isabel talks to both Catherine and Henry, she, you know, it sounds simplistic, but what she says is, you know, receive each other. The anamorph ends. We come together and we receive in love. And I was just watching, I think I mentioned this to you before, the new documentary out about John Lennon versus the United States of America, and how, you know, how the media, when the right took over, if I can say that, and the left seemed to be swallowed up, the media as well, for the last, you know, couple of dozen years, what happens when we're unable to hear ourselves anymore? Where do we then turn? And if we don't, Lennon started to, you know, I think that they were capable of making him sound naive. And what he says over and over in the documentary is, put your energy towards peace and love. And, you know, Gandhi had a point. How does this get lost? I think that's Shakespeare's question.
We turn to Shakespeare, of course. And we hear lines that we didn't always hear. Williams, the soldier, saying, I'm afeard there are few die well that die in battle, for how can they charitably dispose of anything when blood is their argument? Now, if these men do not die well, it will be a black matter for the king that led them to it. Seth Powers, you're Henry in this production. Who is this man, and which of these lines is he not just speaking, but hearing?
Well, Chris, I think I probably do have a slightly different take on it. There's such a strong indictment of and deep irony about war, about the reasons for war. But at the same time, I mean, I've been amazed at how much affection people have for this character, and it's undeniable. There is a nobility, an unshakable nobility, which is a word you don't hear much nowadays, to this character. And it's not as if there is no truth in it. It's as if there are so many truths at the same time. I mean, and it comes out in so many of the scenes, and especially the war scenes. For instance, the Battle of Agincourt, which in each of the movies, Laurence Olivier's and Kenneth Branagh's, is staged as a big epic battle. But in the play, it's not. It's a very, it's a fascinating string of small scenes that certainly seem to lampoon the battle in some way. There is the St. Crispin's Day speech. And then the troops go out, presumably, to fight the battle. But the next scene is a fairly comic scene in which you see a pistol, who is a soldier, capturing a French nobleman through intimidation without really any fighting at all. So there he is capturing a prisoner. And then it proceeds to the next scene. Well, there's a string of them, but you see the French army in complete disarray, and they're fairly comic scenes. They keep talking about the chaos. Both sides actually keep talking about the chaos. It seems to be impossible to tell who is winning and who is losing. Then in the mix of these scenes is is one where Exeter, who is the uncle of Henry, tells Henry that two noblemen have died in this very beautiful and slightly perhaps grotesque description. And this is followed by an alarm that the king, and the king doesn't know what the alarm means at first, and then reads it as an alarm that the French have reinforced their troops and orders all of the prisoners to be killed. And presumably this has something to do with that first scene of the battle where you see Pistol capturing a prisoner. But the prisoners are killed. And then the next scene is the massacre of the boys who were guarding the luggage. And there, another reason is given for the killing of the prisoners. And the king comes in and threatens to kill more prisoners, and then finds out that the battle has been won. Now, it's an extraordinary sequence, and it's not a grand battle scene. And it, we can only assume it's intentional, because Shakespeare could have written a very grand battle scene in, as he did in other plays, the Battle of Shrewsbury, some of, you know, which actually Prince Hal was in. But right there, you can see these truths colliding.
Normie, make sense of all that.
I was just taken by how wonderful that was. I think that as an ensemble, we threw ourselves into this, and what you're hearing Seth and I moving through and thinking through has been the richness of going into this. I think the sense of it is somehow or other deeply inlaid. Chris, forgive me. This isn't, I don't mean to cop out, but I think it's, he's written this on such a deep, psychic, intuitive level that the only way to understand it is to move through it sort of scene by scene, the scenes that Seth has described, allowing your heart to go one way and then the other. And somewhere in the midst, your gut starts to understand what he's saying. And I think as Seth was speaking, the image that came to me was Fluellen being absolutely outraged and horrified that his great hero, was played by Paula Langton, a woman, is she loves all of these historical generals. And when she sees that her beloved king is capable of killing first the boys are killed, which destroys her, and then she sees her king killing POWs and is completely horrified and realizes that Alexander the Great killed his best friend, Henry killed his best friend Falstaff, and who has she put her faith in? And in the next scene, as Seth says, they win, and she suddenly sees a great general again in front of her. And just watching Fluellen's journey is amazing, because I watch my own responses are not unlike hers around this. And what is the track that he's leading us on through this? And I think he's doing it very specifically on that visceral a level. And I don't know that logically one can sum this up as one ever can with his plays, this one particularly.
Speaking of the back and forth, I'm glad you mentioned it, Seth, that this man is infinitely charming, this Henry. And it seemed to me your greatest moments in it are the love scenes at the end where he's courting Kate. She's going to be his bride in any event. But he's pitching her. And he all those incredible lines, one after another, but he speaks of a curled pate. He's telling her, a curled pate will grow bald, a fair face will wither, a full eye will wax hollow, but a good heart, Kate, is the sun and the moon. Put that piece in it. Henry the lover, Henry the dazzling courtier. Is that the same man?
Yes, we have to say yes. we definitely struggled with that final scene, which many people have told me often seems as if it's just sort of tacked on to the end of this war play. So we were trying with our production to see how it might fit into this story of destruction and rebirth. It is very important, this shift, that shift in the last act. I mean, there are basically two gods who keep being mentioned, two of the Greek and Roman gods who keep being mentioned through the play, and one is Mars, and the other is Love, or Cupid. And that shift happens in the fifth act, where, for whatever reason, the king decides to ask for the love of the princess of the country who has been conquered. It's not something that needs to happen, you know. It's an arranged marriage. The scene doesn't need to happen. And yet in that scene he keeps going back to asking her, can you, will you have me? Can you love me? Mm-hmm. Which is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing for a conqueror to do. And so I think, yes, we have to accept that part of the character.
Are we talking about integrating the character or integrating the play? Sometimes I read this play and I think, no, it's just vaudeville. It's just a show. And we got to do a love scene. We got to do a battle scene. We got to do an argument. We got to be clever. We got to be deep and put it all together. And, you know, the box office will be great.
But you don't really believe that, Chris?
No, I don't.
I think it's a brilliant, bloody play. And if this is not a play I would have chosen to do. And when Ben Abbott asked me to do it, I thought, how am I to do this? But because of my own interest in war and my father's background in it, it has opened to me a way of seeing and understanding. Mm. And I say this, and I hope I mean this in 10 years, I think it is a more complex play than Hamlet. It may not be as refined, but I think the answers in here are profound. And if I can do this 3 more times, I might be able to sum something up for you that I can't right now. I am riddled and jangled and delighted by this. And with, you know, my hat's off to these 5 actors who have been incredible in their idiosyncratic, amazing, heart-filled performances and minds in how they pull this apart with me. It's really been an ensemble work in every way. Hmm. So I my mind lies in 5 other people's, I think, in understanding this play.
Coppelia Khan, it's a treat to hear stage professionals arguing about how to do it. What does a professor of Shakespeare say to clarify all this?
Well, I don't think I can clarify this play. I think Shakespeare did indeed make it as complex as Normie and Seth are telling us it is. I think of Shakespeare as always a both-and poet rather than an either-or poet. And what he is doing in this play, he does in pretty much every play. He stages contradictions. He explores, exposes, dramatizes conflicting points of view. It's what Keats praised him for, having that negative capability, the capability not to arrive at a decision, to come to an answer, but to explore what's out there. I can't come down on one side or the other. I don't think Shakespeare wants me to. He wants me to experience to the full the irony and often the tragedy of these contradictions. Yes, Henry is charming, and yes, he is ruthless. He is both.
Let me ask you one. This is a play about guys and how you become a real guy.
Oh, yeah.
A manly man.
Oh, yeah.
And a leader and how you win your spurs.
Yeah. Well, I think Shakespeare is right on top of that. As he has all the way along in the Henry cycle, from Richard II through the first and second parts of Henry IV to this play, he's very much aware that manhood is something you perform. It has a social script, and you learn how to perform what the script requires of you. And one place in the play where you see this very, very clearly is Henry's speech before Harfleur. One of the great, great speeches in the play, no matter what you think of its content, it's a great dramatic performance. And Branagh used, in a sense, that scene as his poster for the movie. There's a striking photo of Henry on his horse, rampant, its hooves clawing at the air, behind him this great gap in the wall of the city of Harfleur and smoke billowing out. And here is Henry, exhorting his troops once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. And as he continues, he tells them how to behave. He says, imitate the action of the tiger, stiffen the sinews, conjure up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. This is what you gotta do. Act like a soldier and you'll be a soldier. For that matter, in the very first chorus, if I'm not mistaken, it is the first chorus, Henry is described by the chorus as warlike Harry, like himself. The king, through Prince Hal and the king, has always been trying to be like himself throughout the whole cycle. He's always been trying to live up to deliver a performance that will pass for a king. And we get a marvelous self-consciousness about this in Henry's famous soliloquy on the eve of Agincourt when he talks about ceremony. He says, well, take away the crown and the robes. I'm just a man like anybody else.
I'd rather be a slave, in fact.
Yeah, he twists the situation so as to pity himself for having to put on this performance. One could give it a different twist and say, well, with this bloody performance of yours, lots of arms and legs are going to be lost. But nonetheless, I think it's an astonishing moment, and it really completes the whole tetralogy, the cycle of four plays, by having King Henry now, that was Prince Hal, be just as aware that it's a performance as he was in the first part of Henry IV, when he comes out in the second scene and delivers this soliloquy about how all his misbehavior is a deliberate publicity ploy to make himself look like a rascal and a reprobate so that when he reforms, people will regard him all the more.
Seth Powers, can the performer cope with all those layers of performance that you're performing about a performance and about a man learning how to play the role?
That is a great question. In a lot of essays, I found people basically saying, well, he's just a juggler. He's just a manipulator. He's basically staging every scene to get exactly what he wants out of people, which may very well be true, but it poses an interesting problem in the theater, in that how would it be possible to show a character playing many parts impeccably? How does that look different than somebody simply going through the story and and performing all of these actions impeccably with integrity of self? Well, it seems to me that part of the answer is that, again, Shakespeare did write plays like that. You look at, say, Richard III. Here is somebody who stages things and says, look, take a look at what I'm about to do. I'm about to lie and I'll win. He does it. Now, Henry V, once again, we get into some very complex territory where he does have one soliloquy in the play, and it is not of that spirit. On ceremony, that basically the difference between a king and a common person is ceremony, which adds up to nothing and a lot of sleeplessness. Yes, and which then, after a knight comes in and tells him that all the nobles are looking for him, and it then goes right into a prayer to the god of battles, which has always fascinated me, the god of battles, presumably God, but also Mars, about not possessing the soldiers with fear and taking from them the sense of reckoning if the opposed numbers pluck their hearts from them. which seems to me to be a very resonant line in the entire, in that scene, you know, where there's so many unresolved issues in all four of the plays. And certainly the justness of Henry's inheritance is a big one, as is the culpability of the king for the war.
Kopeldekhan, I want to ask you about what's by now a kind of very familiar American understanding of Henry V as the wastrel who becomes a real man, an adult. And he stops drinking and he says farewell to Falstaff and he begins anew. Just take that apart. I mean, it is part of the folklore around George W. Bush, too, and maybe John Kennedy and lots of others, past and future. Just take that apart. Is that what Shakespeare is talking about? Or could it be, as Normie suggests, that he's talking about the death of the man?
Well, again, I'd have to say both. The point of having Mistress Quicklie recount Falstaff's death, prefacing it in a preceding scene with the words, "The king hath killed his heart," the point of invoking Falstaff again in this play, who does not appear as a character but is only referred to by others, the point of that is to remind us of the moral and emotional sacrifices that a leader makes. But I want to, having said that, to that extent, I certainly agree with Normie, I really do. But I want to go back to Seth's challenge as an actor. I don't think you can play this play and carry the audience with you unless they like Henry. He's got to still be a charmer. And why did all those hundreds of thousands of voters vote for George W. Bush? And why, as we're in the thick of the electoral primaries now, all the candidates are out there trying to charm the public? They're not trying to convince the public that their political agendas have the most cogency and are the most responsible and moral and effective. They're trying to charm the public. And personally, I'm appalled when I hear voters on the radio say, "Well, I don't really like him because he divorced his first wife." I mean, that's not supposed to have anything to do with it. But in fact, I think we're better positioned today than ever before to appreciate the role that rhetoric and personal charm play in creating leadership. It's at least ironic, maybe it's tragic, but we have to be stirred by the St. Crispin's Day speech. We have to, or this play is dead.
This is fascinating. And just suddenly I'm thinking Prince Hal or King Henry V is the story of our presidential politics in my lifetime. Not everyone, not Nixon, not LBJ, but certainly the script for John F. Kennedy. I mean, I'm a rake. I'm handsome as sin. I will charm the birds out of the trees with my smile. I'm a warrior. I'm a lover. Elect me. Love me. And for all his follies, we still do. And Bill Clinton is a variation.
Oh, definitely. You couldn't have found a more lurid scenario of not exactly the prodigal son, but of a wastrel than Clinton throwing away everything with Monica Lewinsky. And yet,
with Jennifer Flowers before.
Oh, I mean,
and
God.
We knew going in.
Yeah, but Clinton, years later, is still charming his audiences. There's, of course, there's controversy about how much he is helping Hillary or hurting her, or how he ought to help her and ought not to help her. But he is still a draw. He, too, can charm the birds out of the trees, like JFK.
Did it ever occur to you that you're playing a kind of presidential campaign part, Seth Powers, in Henry V?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and way beyond the fact that we now have a president who had his wilder days and has since taken the country into a war that many people question the validity of. But also all of those other politicians that you've mentioned. But I do have to say that in rehearsing it, I had to take a very close look at this, and really the difference also between kingship and running for president, as I believe that kingship is a huge theme in the play. It's not one that may resonate as immediately with us as it did with the original audience, but being a king is not in all ways like being the president. And in that way, some of the scenes with Henry are very strange when he talks about that the troops will become his brothers, the people that shed their blood with him will be his brother. It's a very strange thing for a king to say, and it's pretty normal for our politicians to try to act on that level. So I think, yes, I mean, the parallels are everywhere, but it's often the negative parallels that these politicians are trying to woo us, but that they don't have all of the qualities that Henry seems to have. It seems to me that this play is an extraordinary experiment in a way, going back to the contradictions of it, of having this character enact and go through some horrible things, you know, start a war that may not have needed to happen, assume the port of Mars, and in doing so, convey some hideous threats, take steps to win a battle by slaughtering prisoners, all of these things that the king does. You have a character that goes through all of that and yet is given a conscience of some kind that is clearly important for the play and for the structure of the play. And it may be a conscience that makes people uncomfortable or even infuriates them or whatever it does, but it is there and it is important, and it's a strange concoction, I think. So there is an integrity, there is a story, I believe, of the development of the character. It's not a picaresque kind of journey with this, you know, oily politician. At least it's not for me. You know, selling snake oil all over the place, you know, with no repercussions back. I mean, I think that assuming the port of Mars in itself is not possible without quite possibly losing some part of yourself. It's a terrible mantle.
Well said. Coppelia Khan.
Seth, I think it was wonderful to say that Shakespeare gives Henry V a conscience. On the one hand, he shows Henry doing things that are ruthless. On the other hand, it's Henry himself who ruminates about it and calls to our attention the moral issues involved. So Shakespeare does not create a blameless statue of a hero. He gives us someone whose character has deep shadows as well as this glittering public surface. And he doesn't tell us, Shakespeare does not tell us which way to go. I was reading this morning an essay by a really wonderful Shakespeare critic, Harold Goddard, who lectured on Shakespeare for many years at the University of Chicago. And one very effective thing he says is this: people take the chorus as speaking for Shakespeare. Goddard demurs. He says, no, the chorus with his jingoistic, you know, cheering the troops on, heaping superlatives on Henry. Yes, fair sits the wind for France, etc. That is the voice of every man. That is the audience response, so to speak, to Henry's successful charming of his people. That's what people think once you let slip the dogs of war. That's the way they get on the bandwagon. And Shakespeare makes us experience that. I mean, who can listen to the St. Crispin's Day speech and not be thrilled? On the other hand, who can listen to Henry say, kill the prisoners, and not be appalled?
And he doesn't tell us, Shakespeare, that is, who to vote for in 2008, does he?
No. I think all analogies between then and now have to be quite partial and provisional. But, you know, I think you're really onto something also, Seth. What I took you to be saying was that a king had available to him a cultural set of symbols that were endowed with mana, as the anthropologists say, with some mysterious essence. And once the king has the orb and scepter, he has some kind of magic, whereas we call our president Mr. President. I suppose there's a thrill when they play Hail to the Chief and himself comes striding in. But he's still Mr. President, and he can be out in his ear in 4 years. Doesn't work the same in a monarchy.
The only moral to be taken from it, I think, is that we have to keep listening to Shakespeare, keep watching it on stage, keep talking about it, keep arguing, keep wallowing in the contradictions and learning something about his world and ours. This is a whole lot of fun. Normie Noel of the Actors Shakespeare Project, thank you for joining us. Seth Powers, a magnificent young Henry V in the new production in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you. And Coppelia Khan at Brown University, thank you for bringing it home, bringing it back to the 2008 campaign. Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Please join the conversation with us at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden.